dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A battle space in the past of that war was a place called Vietnam. We did not prosper there due to decisions that were made, regrettably, primarily at the political level rather than at the military one. Those decisions by political figures cost us the chance for victory in that war and inflicted incalculable costs on the people of South Vietnam that many Americans died to try to give a chance for a better future. A man who was on the ground for a good part of the war and who played an important role in arguably one of the most important efforts to have it come out right is our guest for this full hour. His name is Stephen Young. He has a remarkable background in addition to having been prominently involved in and helping to manage something called the Civil Operations for Rural Development System, CORDS, in Vietnam. He is also an attorney by training. He's been the assistant dean at the Harvard Law School, the dean at the Hamline University School of Law. He is, these days, the global executive director of the Co-Roundtable for Moral Capitalism. He is the author of several books, Moral Capitalism, The Road to Moral Capitalism, and The Theory and Practice of Associative Power, CORDS, in the Villages of Vietnam, 1967 to 1972. We're going to talk to Steve Young about not only his experiences in Vietnam, but the lessons that have gone unlearned in another part of the world where we've also spent enormous amounts of lives and treasure trying to give people a better future, a place called Afghanistan. To talk about both, I'm delighted to welcome back Steve Young. Thank you so much for giving us your time, Steve. Good to have you with us.
Great to be back, Frank. Very important conversation.
Well, timely. Timely conversation because this week the Washington Post published a large volume of formerly classified documents, I believe, out of the Pentagon that described the experience in Afghanistan from the perspective of military personnel, Defense Department personnel who were doing kind of a post-mortem on what happened there, the truth about what happened there, very much reminiscent of the Pentagon Papers in the Vietnam era. You've had a chance to read through some of those papers that have been published by the Washington Post, and I wanted to start by just giving you an opportunity to talk a little bit about what we have now seen happening, well, as Yogi Berra said, sort of deja vu all over again, I take it.
Yeah, and it is because, I mean, it's stunning to me all these, 20 years and everything that the Washington Post has revealed, all these comments by military, civilian, state, USAID, Afghans, are all completely predictable. I mean, I predicted them back in 2001, 2003, because we never used a CORDS program. The fact that the United States of America and its best and its brightest, like parts of Vietnam, can't even learn a lesson to get it right is not only embarrassing, this is the way nations fall, this is the way great powers fall. They can't get the job done, and their elite can't get the job done. And all the remedies for what we didn't do are pretty simple. I mean, none of it is rocket science. And I would say the parallel to Vietnam is almost all of these criticisms you could hear in Vietnam in 60, 65 and 66. too much American money being spent. Americans were sort of had too much hubris. They were pushing Vietnamese aside. They were killing Viet Cong, but there were always more Viet Cong being recruited. What did victory look like? What was the end game? And but then, starting in '67, with really led by civilians, Robert Comer, Ellsworth Bunker, Bill Colby, supported by Johnson, we got our act together in a comprehensive program where all the different pieces. It's like basically having one org chart for the whole thing, rather than have 67 different org charts of all these little, you know, units, military, civilian, political, Afghan, NATO, America, all spinning in their own little orbits and bumping into each other.
Now, when you talk about org charts, you're of course talking about organizational charts, and those wiring diagrams are very familiar to anyone who's served in a corporation or a bureaucracy, but perhaps not so much for the rest of us. And I guess the question I would just put to you, Steve Young, is that when you look at these papers, when you look at the collected assessments of what has gone wrong that you predicted would go wrong when we didn't have a CORDS, again, civil operations for rural development support system in place, to try to give the people of the country a stake in its defense in the first instance, but also in terms of its management and productivity. How could it have gone on so long without this kind of information coming to the attention of, well, presumably policymakers at the minimum, but the American people as well? Some things that we could have done differently that might have made a huge difference.
Well, I mean, one is there's a story I can tell you on this, a personal story. But secondly, I think it was the intentional running away from Vietnam. Because we lost the war, everybody concluded, all the military people, everybody, politicians, you know, concluded nothing good came from Vietnam, so let's forget the whole thing. So when we got into Afghanistan and then, a year and a half later into Iraq, we had all this data, we had books, I mean, you know, General Petraeus tried to reinvent part of it with his COIN, C-O-I-N doctrine, but he only got 70% of the system. And so, what does it say when you've got the facts around you, but you intentionally, willingly, don't look them up? Vietnam was not properly taught at the service academies. It wasn't taught in the Foreign Service Institute. The other thing that happened is military and civilian, most of whom were sort of retired by the time we got into Afghanistan, you wouldn't talk about that part of your career. It was a totally different experience from World War II or Korea. You know, you came back from World War II and you've been in the Battle of the Bulge, and what did you spend most of your life talking about? You know, how you won the Battle of the Bulge. Vietnam vets all across, you don't talk. You don't talk to your wife, you didn't talk to your kids, you didn't talk to your Rotary Club people. And my friends who stayed in the military and State Department, they knew, it was just instinct. You were not going to move up the bureaucratic hierarchy by reminding everybody that you'd been in Vietnam. There was something intentional here. It wasn't just negligent. It was a running away from good lessons learned from Vietnam.
Steve, we have to pause, but when we come back, I want to visit with you about your experiences in Vietnam and what this CORDS program actually demonstrated in terms of a counterinsurgency approach that worked, and why in the end we nonetheless wound up losing the war. We'll do all of that and more in just a few minutes with our friend Steve Young, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with Stephen Young, a man who has had quite the run in terms of not just thinking about, writing about, and mulling the hard lessons of the war for the free world, but having actually lived some of them in arguably one of its most difficult places and phases, that is the war in Vietnam. He held several positions associated with something that has been known by its acronym as the CORDS Advisory Program. It stands for Civil Operations for Rural Development Support. And Steve talked a little bit about the fact that we didn't have a CORDS program in Afghanistan, and it's contributed to the debacle that has resulted in almost 20 years of fighting there with very little to show for it. And the prospect of turning the place over to the Taliban with predictably terrible consequences. But before we get to that, Steve, I want to just drill down a bit with you on CORDS and your experiences with it in Vietnam and the effectiveness of it as a counterinsurgency model, perhaps of very considerable relevance to our own time as well.
Absolutely. The simple point, and it kind of boggles the mind, Frank, that in all the reading that you can do about Afghanistan, nobody ever mentioned the core proposition of why insurgencies win. And that was Mao Zedong's famous dictum that the guerrillas are the fish who swim in the sea of the people. And that was understood by some of our people in Vietnam. So we designed strategy and tactics to basically dry up the sea, to turn the people against the insurgents, which we did. And here we are, 2019, in Afghanistan. And I just read there's a statement in these Afghanistan papers that, I don't know, 10 years ago, we were carrying an order of battle of the Taliban of 25,000 effectives. Now I think we're carrying an order of battle of 60,000 effectives. So clearly, they've been supported by the sea of the people.
Well, and the perception that they're winning, too. Obviously, that's a big piece of how the sea ebbs and flows, isn't it? And Steve, when you talked about your own time in Vietnam and the degree to which it, you know, proved to be critical to several different phases of that war, that we had a program for enlisting the support of the people. Richard Nixon famously called it Vietnamization when he became president. Just how did that work on the ground as a practical matter?
Well, as a practical matter, it was, people may go, huh? It's the New England town village meeting, you know, of 18th century New England, where the people in the community met and we were responsible for their own governance, their own defense. Police forces are guarding against Indians coming down from Canada, and economic development, their own roads, their own markets, et cetera, et cetera. And when basically, if you have a stake, as you said earlier, in your village, in your community, with your family, your relatives, your friends, you are primarily not interested in revolution and fighting and violence. And so if you decentralize power, political, economic, and military, to the people, they basically turn, you know, the young men don't join the guerrillas, and the people are willing to report to the police and the army who are the guerrillas. And they know the territory. So when you go into a village of Vietnam and there'd been a raid by the VC or something like that, when the program was up and running, there'd be a number of people would say, yeah, we know the four guys, it's so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so, and they happen to hide out about a half a kilometer down here at the bend in the canal, which means what? Which means the local village troops could go out there. You don't need Americans. You don't need high, you know, helicopters with huge firepower, which are going to make a mistake and blow up a temple or something like that, because the people are in charge of their own destiny. And when that happens, after 6 months or a year, guess what? They get self-confident. They have pride. They begin to get more involved in politics. They say, Vietnam is our country.
They're empowered as owners. And this, of course, is the theme of your book, The Theory and Practice of Associative Power, about the CORDS program, Steve Young. And when you saw these folks taking ownership, how did the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese respond to this development? Obviously, they were determined to try to hold on and expand their power and subvert them. But how did this sort?
Well, I mean, basically at the level of the local South Vietnamese, Well, the basic response of the communist leadership in Hanoi was to send in North Vietnamese battalions and regiments and divisions. As they lost followers among the South Vietnamese, they had to replace them with an invading army. What happened, and the courts program really started 67, it gained momentum after the Tet Offensive of 68, and I think by 72, something like 200,000 former Viet Cong had come over to the government side and then went right back to their villages to guard and defend their villages against the North Vietnamese.
That's a sea change. So then how did this thing go so wrong at the end of the day?
Well, okay, one guy and one date. The guy was Henry Kissinger, and the date was May 31, 1971. And I've looked into this because I worked with Ellsworth Bunker. I've seen the secret cables. I talked to President Nixon. I just found some more documents in the Gerald Ford Library. Kissinger basically had his own private channel with the North Vietnamese, a Frenchman by the name of Jean Saint-Denis, who brought him a deal on May 25 from Hanoi, where Hanoi said, if you guys just get out, we will let South Vietnam survive for a couple of years. And right after that, on May 31, Kissinger gave instructions to Bunker that in the secret negotiations with Hanoi, the Americans would no longer demand that Hanoi remove its regular, its invading army from South Vietnam. So when we left in January 1973, the communists had something like 250,000 to 300,000 regular troops inside South Vietnam. That was no longer a guerrilla war. That was an invasion. And then the Democratic Congress, I'm sorry to say, cut the aid in 74. Hanoi sent down, you know, more tanks, more guns, more troops. And in 75, they launched a focused invasion on a very thin South Vietnamese defense line. And the South Vietnamese, feeling abandoned by the Americans, said, why are you going to fight when you can't win now? Your allies have abandoned you. You know, after all the sacrifices of Americans and South Vietnamese, all the good economic development in the villages, the Americans have dropped you.
Yes. Well, they didn't just feel that way. We actually had. And you know, what's so interesting about this, Steve Young, is that Henry Kissinger has done so much damage in so many different contexts over so many years. This was unfortunately just one example of it. And yet here he is, 90 plus years old, still lionized as the great Svengali of foreign policy. But he was a defeatist. Time and time and time again, he just had concluded we had lost and we just needed to cut our losses. And in the process, that meant, you know, slitting the throats effectively of our friends and allies. And you've married a Vietnamese woman. You have studied closely the history of Vietnam and you're deeply immersed in its culture, of course. Just give us, if you could, in the briefest of form, Steve, what were the consequences of Kissinger's abandonment of the South Vietnamese? And you know, tie it into what you were talking about in the first segment at the beginning, the continuing, you know, costs that we're bearing in a small way relative to, of course, what the people of Vietnam have, but what we ourselves are still bearing as a result.
When the America, I mean, we are a nation which has never known defeat. We are a nation who believes that we are good. In Vietnam, when we lost this way, it was a shock to patriotism. It was a shock to belief in the country. It energized those people in the baby boomer generation who've been arguing that this thing about America being a good nation, a great people, you know, it's not really true. And that, of course, has just led directly to the difficulties we're having now. With an elite, an educated elite, which has an agenda about political correctness and all kinds of things that say, you know, don't be proud, you're an American. And if a person loses self-confidence and pride, we all know what happens to them, right? If a country loses self-confidence and pride, a similar kind of thing is going to happen. They will, to use old Calvinist terms, they will fall from grace and wallow in failure.
And what's so important about this, of course, is it's no longer just the elites, the aging baby boomers or the successor generation to them. It's now something that has been inculcated in a generation or two of younger Americans. And I think you are not overstating the case at all, Stephen Young, to be warning that without some appreciation of what has made this country the indispensable nation, the exceptional nation that it is, we are on a perhaps gradual, perhaps steep downward slide. More in just a few minutes with our friend Steve Young, straight ahead.
Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with an extraordinary man whom I've had the privilege of getting to know now over the recent years, partly because of his free-range mind on a lot of different subjects, and partly because of the subject we're discussing right now, which is what could we yet do to try to assure that we don't abandon Afghanistan as we did Vietnam, with probably comparably horrific consequences for the people involved. And ultimately, I believe, to the great detriment of our own people as well. And Stephen Young, you were talking about our experiences in Vietnam. You were talking about the success of the CORDS program with which you were intimately involved. You were talking about Henry Kissinger's betrayal of South Vietnam. And for that matter, I would argue, all those Americans who lost their lives, some 50,000 of them in the course of that long war, as well as countless Vietnamese and others. And the tragedy of it is that we continue as a country, all these years later, to have a diminished confidence and diminished sense of our goodness, and therefore a diminished role, I believe, in the world that desperately needs us to be all we can be. This is playing out in real time in Afghanistan. President Trump, as you know, made an unannounced trip to Afghanistan to visit with the troops, to feed them Thanksgiving meals, and to talk to the government of Afghanistan, and among other things, announced at the conclusion of it that he was going to reopen negotiations with the Taliban. And remind us just quickly, Stephen, how things were left just 2 or 3 months ago when we were told, to the surprise of many, that the president was about to have a summit session at Camp David with this self-same Taliban. What was going on there, and then what happened?
Well, I think what's going on there is it's Henry Kissinger round two. Someone doesn't have any faith, and this is Donald Trump now, in the fact that we can accomplish anything in Afghanistan. So he's saying, why should we be there? Why should we spend money? Why should we do that? You know, let's just pull out. Not our problem. Without really thinking about the long-term consequences. So you shake hands, you get promises from the Taliban that they will be nice.
But a similar kind of nice for a very short period of time and with a lot of caveats, as it were.
Yes, because all you have is a promise, and you have and they probably have their fingers crossed behind their backs.
No. But it's not. My point is, Steve, it's not even much of a promise. It, as you said about Vietnam, the North was prepared to say, well, we'll let them, you know, continue for a couple of years. But that's just, you know, a stay of execution. It's not a commutation of sentence.
Well, another thing, Frank, on the regional setting here with Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and China. China, for the first time in human history, has the wherewithal, military and economic, to dominate the world. And this is Xi Jinping's plan. So as we get weaker and weaker and pull back, the Chinese were opening up, we're creating a power vacuum around the world for the Chinese to fill with the Chinese model of governance and economics and everything. In India, I just saw a small story in the paper today, the Modi government is introducing a law to change the citizenship law of India to say that people can come to India as refugees from surrounding countries, but not Muslims. So what this says to all the people in Afghanistan, the elite, is that if this thing goes down, the Taliban, they can't even go to India. So talk about, you know, fear and panic, and where are they going to go? And then that means they, what, probably cut a deal with the Taliban? No. So the question is, what do we do? The simple thing is, I think, is that and this is not foolish, because if the cord strategy and counterinsurgencies are based on the people of Afghanistan are still there. The question is, can we get smart? Can we figure out how to work with the people of Afghanistan in their villages? Self-government, self-defense, self-development.
Can we, in other words, if I may, Steve, give them a sense of ownership that you talked about as the byproduct of the CORDS program in Vietnam?
Exactly. And the answer is yes, we can.
Even at this late date?
At this late date, because it's all up to the people. Also, an NGO group and a lot of Afghan women have organized community development councils. There are 18,000 community development councils all across the country associated with NGOs, right? These are little village governments in ab initio, like they're gestating. They're like little babies being born. If we could use those 18,000 councils, including the women involved, to build up, you know, their own schools, their own weaving programs, et cetera, you could suddenly have a presence in the villages all across Afghanistan. And in each village, there are people from that particular tribe, Pashtuns with Pashtuns, Hazara with Hazara, Tajiks with Tajiks. So you don't have the problem of some guy being sent down from Kabul to be a district officer who's of a different ethnic group, and he doesn't like the people he's supposed to be leading, and they don't like him, which is what we've been tolerating for 19 years.
And to the great detriment of the people of Afghanistan, as well as our own forces and interests. And this is, I gather, something that just, you know, screams out at us from these after-action reports and postmortems, if you will, the so-called Afghanistan papers that the Washington Post has published. So if it's still possible to institute a civil operations for rural development support kind of structure, infrastructure in Afghanistan, Stephen Young, how do we go about it? What is the next step? What should President Trump be doing now, even as he is seeking some kind of renewed negotiations with the Taliban?
So, I mean, the first thing he does is he adopts the strategic guidance that the people are the frontline troops. And he builds a partnership with the non-Taliban Afghans, saying it's your people all over the country who have to be helped. And we have to decentralize power. And then that gets to the old org chart, the organization chart, where the Americans, the other allied forces, the different branches of the Afghan government at central, provincial, and district levels have to coordinate under one leader per area, and there's a chain of command that goes up to one American, not a general here, an ambassador over there, and a CIA guy over there. And that one American has to have a direct relationship with the president of the country and an organizing, implementing council. It can be done. But basically, it's decentralization of resources down to the local communities. And the other thing that happens is once you get the local communities developing, the corruption tends to stop, because the people, they know who's corrupt, and they now have power to stop it. So at the same time, by decentralizing power, ironically, and this is what we have never understood, our generals and bureaucrats, by decentralizing power, you actually create a more stable overall system.
Yes. And there's another component to this, Stephen Young, which you and I and Eric Prince have, along with General Jerry Boykin and General Tom McInerney, have advanced, which is the idea of having some kind of additional persistent military capability in the country to support these rural development, sort of entities, but not American boots on the ground in large numbers. Could you just amplify that piece and how important that is to the overall enterprise?
Yeah, because what I mean, the way all warfare works is you mass your forces to strike the enemy where they're weakest. That's what Napoleon did, and that's what MacArthur did at Incheon, et cetera, et cetera. The way guerrillas do it is it's not, divisions. It's like 30 guys against 5 guys. So if they have their 30 guys who come at the 5 guys defending a village, who are now outgunned and outnumbered, if they have immediate communications with a rapid reaction force that's reliable, that can come in by helicopter very quickly, or gunships, and then they tell the plane flying up there exactly where the Taliban are and where to shoot them, their courage tends to, it's a force multiplier, right? Rapid reaction forces are a force multiplier, and you don't need to have too many of them, right? You stage them in various small bases here and there, but you make sure that the communications with the village, radio, and now we've got satellite and stuff. It's much better than it was in Vietnam. You train them with a sense of discipline and esprit de corps to say, we are here to support the people. We've got frontline troops, okay? They may not be wearing uniforms, they've got funny hats, they've got this, but they're defending their wives, their daughters, their grandfathers, their fields. And we're going to make sure that they will not be outgunned or overwhelmed. And then that thing tends to take on, again, a self-fulfilling growth of self-confidence.
It builds that confidence, which is the essential ingredient in encouraging them to feel ownership and hold the line and defend their property and defend their families and defend their communities, defend their tribe against these others. And at least if the Vietnam model pertains. And when we come back after a very short break, Steve Young, I want to ask you about this because you've studied these matters very closely. Will the fact that you have running throughout this society the strain of Sharia supremacism and the loyalty to Allah and the tenets of Islam militating against this kind of flipping, if you will, I think is the word you use, flipping of the Taliban and other kinds of jihadists who are currently causing such havoc to the people of Afghanistan, or will they remain unaffected by this effort to stave off their predations? We'll talk about that and much more in our final installment with Steve Young right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We have been speaking, I think, incredibly importantly, with a man who actually was deeply involved in the last successful counterinsurgency operation the United States has mounted, that in Vietnam known as the CORDS program, the Civil Operations for Rural Development Support. His name is Stephen Young. He's a brilliant mind with much insight into the challenge that we're facing, very similar to what we faced in Vietnam, not identical, of course, but very similar to Vietnam in Afghanistan. And Steve, I just wanted to close this conversation out with you by talking a little bit about the dangers associated with failing to get this right and what President Trump specifically can and should be doing that would give people on the ground in Afghanistan both the wherewithal and the confidence that you've described here is so needed. And what happens if we fail to do so?
Well, I think, I mean, what happens if we fail to do so is I think the resistance to the Taliban just evaporates. The elite, the people who don't want to live, will flee somehow, somewhere. The people of Afghanistan will go back to a very austere, religious, Salafi, Wahhabi form of Islam, which may or may not, I mean, I can't predict that. I don't really know that much about the Taliban. My gut feeling is now they probably won't want to make common cause internationally with the remnants of ISIS or Al-Qaeda or anything, but they would still be a point of Islamic militantism for other radical Muslims in Pakistan and India, and which are now at poised at a knife edge over Kashmir. So that's a regional problem, which if that all falls apart, that only contributes strategic advantage to the Chinese, allowing them to move into the southern part of Central Asia.
Yeah, they're there already. They're mining and trying to exploit the resources of the country. But let me put this slightly differently, because again, there are parallels, but it's not an identical set of circumstances. One question that I have, and I think you've studied all these topics fairly closely, Steve Young, but when you look at the kinds of decisions that prompted, as you said earlier, large numbers of Viet Cong to abandon, you know, that insurgency and come over to the side of the South Vietnamese and to work in their villages as part of the defense of their communities against the North Vietnamese in that case. Is it possible to have a similar kind of turnabout among the Islamists, whosoever banner they're flying at the moment, whether it's the Taliban or the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, you know, the Kazani group or what have you, when the sort of operating code they're working with is of this, you know, divinely ordered call to jihad, and that they must engage in, you know, supremacism with respect to Sharia. Is it possible, in other words, for Kurds to have a similar kind of effect, do you think, given the cultural differences in Afghanistan?
Well, yes, I do. It's a long conversation, but the Afghans have to do it for themselves. We can encourage, guide, do various things, but there has to be something we have never tried in Afghanistan, which is we have to confront Islam as a religious, theological, social, cultural, political force. And the vast majority of Muslims in the world are not fundamentalist radicals, but they've never been organized or given theoretical arguments based on Quran that tells them, you're right, those guys are bad. You're going to heaven and they're going to hell. And when, after 9/11, when we started the war on terror, sort of on the side, I began to get involved to see if the counterinsurgency principles of turning the people against, you know, against the insurgents could work within Islam. And I think they can. But you have to have people who are willing to sort of, A, study the Quran, and B, learn a comfort level with a lot of Muslim scholars. One concept is, it's called shirk. It's in Quran. It's not talked about very much. Shirk is the most heinous crime a human being can commit, which is to become a partner with God. Now, Quran also says that God decides who lives and who dies. That means human beings are not authorized to decide who lives and who dies. So therefore, you have Osama bin Laden and the Taliban and all these people committing shirk. And I've tried this on a number of Muslims here and there around the world, and they look at me, their eyes sort of get big, and say, well, who told you that? And I said, well, I just read the Quran, you know. I'm not a Muslim. I'm just asking you. And then you immediately sense they begin to change. They begin to grow in self-confidence that there's a theological argument, which is basically silent so far, which they can use against the extremists. And that would then, if we do, this would have to be done very quickly and very importantly with the imam at Jahalabad and things like that, to give these local government people a sense that Allah is on their side or they're on Allah's side. There are other concepts such as amana, and that you're trusted, you're a khalifa under God, you have responsibilities to take care of the world in a constructive way. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that could be done, Frank. But our people have never even tried to do it.
But in the end, ultimately, I think it probably, you would agree, falls again to the people. It falls to the Muslims themselves to do this. And I'm impressed by this mantra that we hear from the Muslim Brotherhood and, you know, Al-Qaeda and ISIS and, well, for that matter, the authorities of the faith, that the gates of Iftishad are closed.
So now that's a key one. That's a key one. Yeah, but that's a key one because you can go in and argue that's not in the Quran anywhere.
But to just explain that quickly, because we're almost out of time, but I do want to get this idea across. How do you convey the idea that you can, in fact, have different interpretations of Islam? You can, in fact, reform it. You can, in fact, hold people up to a totally different program than Sharia.
I'm being a little bit fast here, but you quote Quran. You don't use your own arguments. I mean, what I've tried to do is learn to say, look, I'm not a Muslim, you know that, but when I read Ayah 27:31 in an English translation, oh, and by the way, I've read two or three English translations, it seems to me it says this. What do you think? And all of a sudden, the conversation changes because you are bringing to the attention, you're elevating the importance of passages of the Quran, which the fundamentalists overlook. And you're not telling Muslims, you know, what, you know, you're just asking questions, right? Geez, I read this ayah, it looks really interesting. What does this mean? Now, I don't have enough experience to say we could, you know, it's a slam dunk thing, but we've never really tried it.
But I am aware of efforts that are incubating, notably in Indonesia, and I believe in other places as well, for Muslim scholars and faith leaders who recognize that the practice of their faith, according to the tenets and dictates of Sharia, is, you know, contrary to their beliefs and their understanding of, you know, the character of Islam, and are working to try to advance those alternative notions. And it certainly seems to me that while ultimately it is up to them to do, we cannot dictate to them or even inform them in all likelihood. But nonetheless, we should be supportive of those sorts of efforts, because at the end of the day, whether it's in Afghanistan or whether it's in Saudi Arabia or whether it's in Egypt or whether it's in Indonesia or other parts of the world, here in the United States as well, if we don't find an alternative to, an antidote, if you will, from within Islam to what these enemies of most Muslims, they've done the most lethal damage to them, after all, even more than to others, as well as to the rest of us, will ultimately, I'm afraid, prevail in substantial measure. So these are the things we're called, I believe, to do. And Stephen Young, as always, your insights into how we might do these things, how we might help the people of Afghanistan not abandon them, how we might help preserve a measure of stability and hopefully security for the part of the world that we've invested so much in, how we might ensure that we don't have the knock-on effects in this war for the free world that will be disastrous for us as well as many, many others. All of those insights and recommendations are so deeply appreciated. And Steve, come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.